This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Literary Studies. My name is Hal Kose, a host at New Books in Poetry. And today I'm very excited to be talking to Virginia Jackson, Chair of Rhetoric at UCI, about her new book, Before Modernism, Inventing American Lyric. Hi, Virginia. Thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you.
Wonderful. Could you, usually we ask guests just to start by telling us a little bit about themselves, and in particular, I guess, how you came to work on poetry and the history of poetics.
Hi, well, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. I've worked on poetics for a long time. I actually, in graduate school, was in comparative literature, and I was very much a kind of theory of poetics person, especially French poetics, as it turned out. So I was writing a dissertation on the imaginary book in Mallarmé and Dickinson, a really, you know, kind of late 80s, early 90s sort of complete project. And I got very taken with what Dickinson's poems actually were. That is, these weird manuscripts, you know, that had bugs folded into them and things like that. And so became progressively less interested in the imaginary book than in these things. And so from that, I think my interest in, of all things, 19th century American poetics emerged, because that wasn't something I had any interest in or any education in. At that point, people weren't really teaching 19th century American poetics other than Emerson and Whitman and Dickinson. So when I started, is this the kind of answer you wanted?
This is great, yeah.
Going on and on. When I first started teaching it, I copied 19th century anthologies because there weren't any available, you know, there just weren't. So gradually started to educate myself in 19th century American poetics and became really fascinated with this occlusion. Like, why did it go away? You know, why was there such a rejection of this stuff, which seemed, even major figures like Longfellow, who, you know, was kind of like, it's kind of like they're not being Tennyson or something, you know, or Wordsworth, like it didn't make any sense. And so, you know, but then I've always been involved with contemporary poetics too. So I also write about 21st century people. And so, you know, I kind of, I don't know, ended up being a 19th and 21st century person. I kind of skipped the 20th.
Skip the 20th. Okay. Yeah. And, but it's interesting to hear you talk about that though, because that sort of experience of strangeness, no, it seems to be an abiding thing, right? You talk often and in different places about how do we know that the thing in front of us is a poem? And what do we mean by that? So that seems to be something that kind of almost comes out of that initial experience of looking at these texts and thinking, what are these and how are we to read them, right?
Yes, yes, very much so. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think that the strangeness, right, is built in some ways to the contemporary reception of poetry. You know, who reads it? How do people read it? Why do you go and read a poem of all things? And truly, you know, I mean, as everyone knows, the 19th century verse is the, you know, is the set of most read genres, right? The popular genres, not strange at all to people, but strange to us. So yeah, I think you're right. I'm attracted by that strangeness. Yeah.
Great. So let's move on and begin talking about, this new book, Before Modernism. I was trying to think of where we could start. And I thought that, you know, early on you talk in the book about the idea of undisciplining. So to undiscipline our kind of 20th and 21st century disciplines and their assumptions and how they color and condition the way we look back at these histories. So I know it's a big question, but maybe we could start with what are some of the assumptions of poetry studies and the history of poetics, which this book kind of moves or is interested in undisciplining?
Yeah, so undisciplining, I think that it comes out of a conversation, you know, it's happening really more in Victorian studies these days about undisciplining Victorian studies, but also Christina Sharp has suggested that in Black studies, in order to think about Black studies in relation to the history of literary forms, right, we'd have to undiscipline the way that we're basically trained to think about these things. And so I think I wanted to suggest something like that. But in the case of the history of American poetry, as I was just saying, you know, we don't really have histories of American poetry. So there are a lot of assumptions in the discipline. And I'm really talking here about the discipline of Anglo-American literary studies. I think, you know, part of the reason this is a book about American lyric is from a historical poetics perspective, and I'll say more about historical poetics in a moment, it becomes very hard to make statements about theory of the lyric, for example, without a place and time for the kind of lyric, or as in my terms, lyricization, how things become lyrics. In the first place. And so it became a book about American lyric because, you know, you can't write about all places and all times. And I became especially interested, as I'd said, when I was working on Dickinson in 19th century American poetics and the way in which that history was just left out, so that in the discipline of Anglo-American studies, as at least in my education, we jump from the British Romantics to the American Modernists, with maybe a little influence of Whitman in between, you know, free verse, but really it's the Shelley to Stevens kind of model. And I thought, well, why? And, you know, were these American poets just bad? And to a certain extent, you know, I think that has been a view, that a lot of them are just bad, or the word really often used is conventional. You know, read a poem by Longfellow and then read a poem by Keats, and like, who would you rather read? And I get that, actually. And we can talk about the autonomy of the aesthetic object in a minute as well, you know, what that means for thinking about poems. But But I do think that, you know, there's this, you can't really account for the history of American poetry and leave a long century out. You know, kind of nothing happens until the first issue of Poetry Magazine in 1912 or something. Yeah.
But maybe, can we pick up on that? That question of conventional is quite fascinating, though, because, I mean, conventional is a criticism, as in if you read something and you think it's bad and you say it's conventional, you could almost turn it around and say that something that is very successfully conventional establishes new conventions, though, and that seems to be the ground on which a lot of historical poetics moves, no? Is this question of what it means now to spot certain conventions and what it meant then. Yeah. And maybe you could just kind of talk about historical poetics in particular as a project.
Yeah. So historical poetics is something that a group of us, really, it was just people working in 19th century, again, Anglo-American, mostly Victorianists, and then people working in American 19th century poetics of the few of us. And we just started reading things together because we realized that we just didn't know. We just hadn't read them. And especially prosody. So out of historical poetics, a whole discipline has emerged of historical prosody, Yopi Prinz, Meredith Martin, especially working on, you know, what for Yopi's work, for example, what the hexameter mania was and why people cared so much about the difference between quantitative meter and accentual syllabic meter. So we started reading around and realizing that, of course, the discourses in which these conventions, as you say, emerged were not of the discourses in which, you know, that we're thinking of when we're reading 19th century poem. They're not our discourses about poetry, right? They influenced our discourses, but they're not. And so we were really fascinated to read so much 19th century, you know, debate. Really, all this emerges from these furious 19th century debates about poetics. And that became very fascinating to us because, like, why do people care so much? Like, why is Poe so crazy about the spondee? Like, why does he care? Why does he care that Longfellow wrote bad hexameters? Like, what's up with that, right? Why did Arnold think that, you know, English hexameters were barbaric? Like, why? Like, what's at stake? And so historical poetics really grew out of those questions and really changed the way that we thought about, as you say, a convention. What was an important convention? What wasn't an important convention? How things got made into conventions, for example. Yeah.
And I want to bring lyric into this now, I think, because thinking about convention and the book is about inventing American lyrics. So could you talk a little bit about what's at stake with the lyric in your work, and also in a way, because it feels like the let's say the kind of focus on the lyric for the last a long time now. No, as you're describing in the book, you know, speaks to all kinds of anxieties and covers all kinds of cultural problematics. And so, if we could bring lyric into this, that would be great.
Yes. So, I mean, I think that my focus on lyric was a bit of an accident in the sense that when I wrote the book on Dickinson, it seemed that what happened to those pieces I was talking about before, those scraps wrapped around bugs and letter and poetry and letters and all the things she wrote, love letters especially, were edited. So she died in 1886. She's posthumously published in 1890 in volume form for the first time. And then, of course, there are a number of editions until the so-called complete edition in 1955. And it seemed to me progressively that these poems were made into lyrics, that is, short poems, you know, in the conventional definition, the romantic definition, brief poems of subjective expression. That was really the model used for editing Dickinson. And so in that work, I became really interested in like what this thing is that we call lyric. And as you know, that's led to a number of debates. And so, in my definition for the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics, I try to say that, you know, lyric means different things at different times. And again, this is a kind of historical poetics definition of lyric. Lyric for a long time wasn't especially considered a major verse form. Lyrics can be minor, right? Or lyrics could be song or various song forms. It wasn't really until pretty much late 18th century, and different people have different theories about how lyric became one of, by the time Goethe writes, right, the Divan, one of the tripartite structure of literature, he says, is narrative, drama, lyric. And then he kind of retro projects that and says, you know, that's an ancient division. And as Gérard Genette writes in The Architect, that's not, lyric isn't part of an ancient division. It's a modern idea. And so I became really interested in how this modern idea, you know, why, how and why this modern idea came about. And so, I wrote that definition. Yopi Prince and I co-edited The Lyric Theory Reader, in which we collected a bunch of some 21st century essays on lyric theory, just to show, really, the reason we made it an anthology rather than, although there's a lot of our prose in that book, is just to show that everybody means something different by lyric. I mean, it's amazing in that book, right? Everybody seems to mean something different, right? You know, we like to say, you know, Adorno means lyric with a K, you know, the German lyric, the Hegelian lyric. But, you know, when, say, Amir Mufti is writing about Adorno in relation to the Huzzle, that's really a very different lyric. And so, you know, everybody means something different when they say it. It seems to be a term with an enormous amount of elasticity.
It is also, I mean, I can see that elasticity, but there are some kind of, let's say, predominant characteristics, you know, that you kind of put out in the book. So, I mean, and it's something I've encountered as well. You know, this sort of, I've noted it down here as a sort of foundational notion for 20th century and 21st century thought in Western poetics, which is the lyric speaker that is organized around an abstraction, right? This sort of, I think you describe it in the book at one point as recessive, no? And that phrase also, eloquent absence. Could you talk a little bit about that particular kind of mid 20th century onwards, I guess, association between lyric and abstraction, and then maybe we can come on to the question of race and racialization in terms of that which the book dives into.
Yeah, so I think that often when I teach 19th century Anglo-American poetics, I'm always telling the students, you know, it's the poet, not the speaker, but they are always saying the speaker. And the reason they're always saying the speaker is because they're educated to say the speaker. They're educated not to say it's the biographical poet, right?
But I do it when I'm writing all the time. I have to, what else do you use?
I know. What else do you use? Right? Like you take the speaker away from people and they can't read a poem, mm-hmm. Because it's the organizing principle. I became really interested in where does that come from? Why do we think there are speakers? Because it's pretty clear, right, that there's not, I mean, you know, think of any 19th century poem that you know really well, right? Keats's Odes, for example, that's not a speaker. So I thought, well, how do we get that idea? And so, of course, there's a literary critical genealogy. You know, the literary critical genealogy really has to do with Cleanth Brooks. You could say it's implicit in the practical criticism with Richards, but it's really the Americans that push the speaker idea. And Steve Newman thinks that Brooks got it from ballad discourse, this idea of a speaker. I think that's an interesting idea. And certainly in the American context, the literary critical line that goes from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow at Harvard, who founds the American version of comparative literature there in the 1840s, on Goethe's Weltliteratur model. So he really makes an idea of world poetry in the middle of the 19th century. And then Francis Child, then makes the Scottish and English ballad project on the basis of the Volksgeist. They all go to Germany for graduate school, right? And get this kind of Volksgeist education and come back and look for the American folk. It's another way to think about it. And so Child collects the Scottish and English ballads in order to, you know, really establish this kind of white American folk. And then this guy named Francis Barton Gummery that nobody reads anymore, because he's actually been owned by the white nationalists a bit. He is very popular theorist of the ballad and of democracy and poetry. And he's like the president of the MLA, things like that, and the turn into the 20th century. And it emphasizes that the ballad has the speaker, which is all of us, right? We're all the speaker of the folk is the speaker of the ballad. And so in that sense, there's a kind of groundwork of the idea that the speaker speaks for all of us. And then Brooks, when he's doing his IMFL in England, he writes his master, he writes that on ballads, on that idea. And then in his work in Understanding Poetry, that textbook, right, that educates generations of Americans anyway, into the close reading of poetry, it's all about the dramatic speaker. So that's the literary critical genealogy on the American side.
Okay. And then kind of the next step might be, how does that speaker come to be an alienated one? Or why do we think of it as a speaker? I mean, there's the kind of Adorno, Benjamin, the kind of shock of the modern no, and that being a retreat, but that seems to be the next important piece of the story, no?
It does. So when I started writing before modernism, when I got a National Endowment of the Humanities grant to write it, a couple of them actually, it was a project about why 19th century American poetry is popular, right? And poetry isn't popular anymore in the same way. And so there was this kind of public poetry project discourse behind it and the more I worked on it, the more I realized that one of the reasons that 19th century American poetry has faded from view is that, you know, it's the 19th century. It's full of the problems of, you know, racism and genocide that is the, you know, that is the American 19th century. So I was very struck at the kind of anxiety of, you know, sort of Longfellow's very white version of a world literature. Like, why is that? Why does he need to do that? And so the social intent that the Adorno you're alluding to, I repeat that phrase from Lyric and Society a few times in the book, that lyric is the expression of a social antagonism. The social antagonism, there are many, of course, social antagonisms in the middle of the American 19th century, but I had never seen someone think about racialization as formative of what we now think of as poetic form, or of the way in which all these genres. And then, so my theory at the beginning of the project was what I call lyricization. So the way that all kinds of popular genres, elegies and odes and ballads and drinking songs and epitaphs and hymns, especially and odes, that are popular in the 19th century get mushed really into a very lyricized idea of poetry at the beginning of the 20th century. That is, you know, like a thing, something that's called poetry in general, and that is identified with a person, or as you say, a single speaker, rather than all these popular genres. And the book I thought I was writing, I was trying to figure out how that, like, why does that happen? It more and more seemed to me that it happens on the basis of racialization, which is kind of obvious in American, you know, anybody who does American history would think everything happens on the basis of racialization, but I just didn't think about it in relation to the process of lyricization. And so, so that's what happened. I started reading, and I read also, and Ivy Wilson, especially, and Matt Sandler, the people who are doing the amazing archival work in thinking about 19th century Black poetics, really changed my view as well. So once Ivy made James Whitfield's work available and Matt Sandler's book, I was already working on this project, but all talking to Matt Sandler by the time his book came out on the Black Romantic Revolution. And once I began to reread the work of Phyllis Wheatley, who is just, you know, everything, and everybody is kind of rediscovering that now. I think Wheatley was just the emerging readings of Wheatley, especially by young scholars, at the moment, are just amazing. So I mean, it was a kind of process for me, a long process of first trying to think about 19th century public poetry, especially, and then realizing the kinds of interventions that Black poets were making and what happened to American poetics as a result of those interventions, and what is essentially that antagonism in the history of American poetry.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, which is, of course, to historicize what otherwise becomes a kind of second order abstraction, no, as in the lyric is an alienated person, right, of a social antagonism, right, but we're asking what social antagonisms,
like, and the second and order when, abstraction, no, of the speaker,
maybe,
in particular,
to try and give some sense of the real fine grain of the argument in the book, we could turn to a few of the chapters and talk in a bit more detail about them and some of the figures in them. So the chapter on Ann Plato, for example, that you begin the book with, and I also want to come on to the genre of person, which seems very much related to what we were just saying, but maybe you could just talk about why you wanted to start with Plato and how she kind of sets the scene for the discussions in the book that follow.
So part of this project is thinking about the common, right? Like, what kind of poetry was just everyday common poetics in the 19th century. And so Plato, I think, is a really good representative, right? So I don't mean to diminish her author function at all. I mean, she's a really interesting author. She has only one book when, you know, she's very young, and then she herself kind of disappears. Like, we don't know what happens to her. She's probably of a mixed indigenous and black heritage. We don't know that for sure either. We don't know that much about her. So, but what I'm really interested in her poetics is that this is really just kind of common, ordinary, and important for that reason, I think, Black poetics in the 19th century. And we just don't have, we're just beginning to recover a lot of this work. And so Plato, she writes, especially her First of August poem, which is what I spend the most time on in that chapter. And First of August poetry itself seems to be just an enormous popular genre. Everybody's writing it. And so hers seems to me representative, but it's not only representative of Black poetics in the period, but it's also representative, I think, of women's poetics. And so and there's this intersection between Black poetics and the figure of the poetess and feminized poetics that I'm really interested in the entire book, right? So I kind of set it up in the Ann Plato chapter and then come back to it at the end of the book with the poetess.
Yeah, there's a kind of refrain throughout the book, I think, also, maybe this is another way into some of what we're talking about, of how these poets kind of saw lyricization coming, no? And how a lot of their writing in a way anticipates and is in some ways a response to something that will then come to pass, no, in the rest of the 19th century. So could you talk about what it is you mean when you say that they saw lyricization coming, and what that and how that process then kind of unfolds and proves them to have been absolutely right also in the book's argument?
Yeah. Like, don't think it was hard to see coming, you know? That was the thing. I mean, so in Plato's case, you know, I talk about it as a kind of, you know, almost passively putting these things into conversation with one another, you know, the nationalizing impulse of abolition. So she's talking about British manumission, right, as something that hasn't happened yet in North America, right, where in fact enslavement is expanding at that moment. And she's a free woman in Connecticut. So she's in a way kind of mapping these discourses onto each other, right, and pointing out the way they don't really fit, and that there's no real position from which to apostrophize, that's the figure I'm thinking of here, to address, right, to create this kind of mode of poetic address that would have any agency in this process. And in fact, she's really pointing to the pathos of indeterminate agency that I think, you know, becomes associated with romantic poetics generally, but here it's very located, right, in a political moment. And I think for somebody like Whitfield, James Monroe Whitfield, who's in such, you know, Matt Sandler calls him the heavy metal of 19th century Black poetics, and he really is. You know, it's not passive, right? It's so he's just furious, and he has a poetics in which his America, right? You know, that land of blood and cruel and wrong. You know, he's just absolutely sending up any nationalist discourse that pretends to, you know, actually be able to claim anything like freedom and liberty in a land in which enslavement is expanding. And so, and again, you know, Whitfield is a free man doing this, and he's called the barber poet. He hated that because he was identified with his profession. But he's a Freemason, a Black Freemason, involved in Prince Hall Freemasonry with Martin Delaney. And they are Black nationalists, and they're looking for a place in which, you know, there would be something like a free black state, right? So he is actually, so I think Plato's actually, you know, sort of pointing out in some ways that there's no such nationalist platform.
Right. Okay.
He's looking for one. I mean, he actively looked for one in Costa Rica, in Haiti. He ended up in California thinking he could make it in California. And of course that didn't happen either.
And so this is why these poets kind of innovate a way of thinking about personhood, right, and its position within the poem, which we might think of in the kind of usual, let's say, standard narrative as sort of romantic alienation from an industrialized society, but actually here has a much more precise grounding in historical conditions, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Can we bring in Phyllis Wheatley as well? Because that chapter on her is also very important in terms of this idea of depersonification or personification and resisting ways in which you might be forced to sort of assume a personhood, no? That you're actually prevented from taking on.
Yeah. So each of the chapters in the book focuses on a poetic figure, mm-hmm. or, you know, some element, kind of fundamental element in poetics, right? So the Whitfield chapter I was just talking about focuses on apostrophe. The Plato chapter is really about abstraction and more general way, the abstraction, as you said, of the person. But then the Wheatley chapter is really about the figure of personification. And since the figure of personification is really a privileged figure in 18th century poetics, I think about personification and Wheatley because Wheatley is using all of the techniques of 18th century Anglo poetics, the couplet. There's, you know, she really just my language for what she does to the couplet is that she replaces its software. But, you know, in Jericho Brown, so Jericho Brown has these sonnets that he calls gutted sonnets, he calls duplexes. And I think that what Wheatley's doing is gutting the couplet. But one of the ways in which she guts the couplet is also on the basis of the figure of personification, which is such a privileged figure in 18th century poetics. And she just over and over has these extraordinary moments of depersonification, moments when she creates a personification or adopts one, and then that personification just falls apart or is scattered or is disseminated or destroyed. And it's interesting. I looked and looked, and there doesn't seem to be any terminology either in the 18th century or in contemporary poetics for depersonification. Which is interesting because it's something I think we all recognize happens all the time in poems. But in Wheatley, as you say, it's like the political motivation in Plato and in Whitfield and all the figures I talk in, certainly Douglas, right? And certainly, you know, all the figures I talk about in the book, that Wheatley's position as an enslaved teenager and a deeply traumatized enslaved teenager who is also, as they called her, the sable prodigy, right? This extraordinary technician. She was the one, you know, she basically takes that figure of personification and reorients it so that, you know, you can't, like, the fictions crumble, but what's left is the person. And because Wheatley is so famous, that is, she becomes identified. There's no poem you read of Wheatley's in which the point isn't that Wheatley wrote it in the 18th century or now. That her person upstages her poem. And so in that way, I think in many ways, she is the book's called Inventing American Lyric, which is clearly a kind of gesture toward a kind of Annales school idea of historical poetics, right? But I think if there is an inventor, you know, like an origin of some way, in some sense, it's Wheatley.
And the chapter is also a really just kind of, it's a great guide to the persistence in her reception of this kind of need to locate her as a person. Maybe here we could talk, because it's kind of, I mean, this phrase, the genre of person, is scattered across the book. Sometimes at very important points. Yes, and it has to do obviously with everything we've been talking about and lyricization. But could you describe a little about where that phrase comes from and what it's doing across the chapters?
So part of my idea about lyricization, the way in which all these genres collapse into some big idea of poetry identified as lyric, has to do with what I say in the book is that the genre of the poem becomes the genre of the person, or is replaced by the genre of the person. So the crossing of race and gender in the 19th century, the genre of the person is foregrounded, but also abstracted. So the person, right? Even the definite article is something, the obvious giveaway. What is the status of the person? So of course, enslaved people are not, right, legally people. And neither, of course, are women until the coverture in 1853. But even after that, right, they don't vote until 1920. There's a material basis, right, for the questioning of the status of the person, but the way in which it works itself out in these poems is that the abstraction of the person actually, you know, abstracts the genre of the poem at the same time. If, for example, to take Wheatley, if her person is more important than the fact she's writing in a pillion, for example, in the beautiful Niobe poem, then you were going to read it on in relation to Wheatley, which is a kind of also interesting dialectic, right? Given what we were saying about the speaker, the way in which the author is supposed to be displaced by the abstract speaker. And so I don't know if this is the place for me to say this, but this is actually only half the book I meant to write. So I meant it to be all the 19th century, but that was just crazy, of course. And so I'm now finishing the second half. And in the second half ends with Dunbar and the dialect speaker. And I think that so that's not feminized, right? That's a dialect speaker that really kind of fetishizes and objectifies this, as you said, alienated speaker of lyric in a way that is really important for then what happens to American modernism.
Okay. And is the new book kind of structured in a similar way, in that there's a sort of rhetorical figure or kind of
No, it's really three poets. It's Walt Whitman, and Albury Alston Whitman, and Paul Dunbar. So they're all men. The thing about the Whitman and the Dunbar, right, is that people say of American poetry that, you know, Whitman invented modern American poetry. It's kind of common to think of Whitman as the beginning, and that Dunbar is, you know, there's a huge debate, right, in the history of Black poetics about Dunbar. I mean, James Weldon Johnson says in 1925, you know, alas, right, he's so important, and yet we need to break free of these folk forms and make a new modern American Black lyric, that we need to not do the dialect thing anymore. I mean, in fact, Johnson in his autobiography says he gives Dunbar a copy of Whitman and says, this is the way you should write.
Okay.
And Dunbar is like, throws it across the room. So it's counterintuitive to think of Dunbar as the beginning of, as a turning point anyway, in the idea of the abstract speaker and the dramatic situation and modern poetics. But I do think that's actually what happens. So yeah, that's that. That's the book that's not there yet. But you're right, I think, about this book before modernism. I mean, modernism doesn't happen for a long time. It's a kind of prehistory. It's kind of trying to replace that narrative of British Romanticism to American modernism, by saying, like, look, there's this other thing that happens.
Yeah, and also I read it even as, I don't know how to express this, but it's not as in, it is a periodization as in before what we understand to be modernism, but the book is also at pains to, like we said earlier about when you describe kind of poets seeing things coming. So it's also at pains to try and understand historically what that moment was before modernism was there, no? Which is that's a very important part of its argument, no? Which is obviously part of its historical perspective. Yeah. Sorry.
And well, I mean, I think you can especially see that with Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who is just such an extraordinary poet. And everybody, you know, it's funny, everybody knows she's an amazing poet, but people still kind of patronize the early poetry by saying it's sentimental, it's just conventional, that word we were using before. You know, it's basically giving people what they want for the popular abolitionist cause. But Frances Harper, you know, she lives from 1825 to 1911. Like, she's in the entire 19th century. And she does so many different kinds of activist, Black feminist work. And she really is a person who understands, I think, as you say, sees something coming in the way in which poetics being used, especially for kind of nationalist, triumphalist, white purposes. And she's amazing. Yeah.
And maybe just kind of as a sort of final question or something that I really wanted to ask you about, which maybe doesn't fit in a chapter because it's a methodological question, really, which is slow reading, which you mentioned early on, and then the chapters kind of demonstrate. What is slow reading?
What is slow reading? Yeah, you know, slow reading is a phrase, so I kind of ironically borrowed from Reuben Brower, who is really, you know, yeah, slow reading is really a phrase borrowed from Reuben Brower. And so, you know, that's ironic because he's an American, first Amherst, and then he works with Robert Frost, and then Harvard professor who then trades Helen Vindler and Paul DeMond, Stephen Orgel, all these people who go on to really be theorists of how you read poetry. And so he really believes in the dramatic fiction of the speaker. And so I'm actually using his phrase to do something very different, which is to think about what the way I think about slow reading is that, you know, in a historical poetics perspective, it takes a long time to read a single poem because not everything actually is on the page. You know, we're trained as close readers to read the text and only the text, or as practical readers to read the text, but things keep popping out of it. So, for example, that Harper poem, Eva's Farewell, which is just a really small, apparently marginal poem, right? Things just kept popping out of that poem. Songs and things that were very much outside the text. And so slow reading takes, I mean, I just mean it in a literal sense. It takes a long time to read a poem that way.
And yeah, but it's also, it's this wonderful feeling of staying with the text, even whilst you're kind of looking elsewhere, right? But the text is always there, you know? It still has a closeness to it. I think you talk about this as well. It's not in any way divorced from the text, but it's trying to kind of place it.
Well, that's really
time.
True, which brings us back to what you were saying earlier, pointing anyway to Benjamin's, you know, and Adorno's or Frankfurt School idea of the autonomy of the work of art, right? To what extent is slow reading really focused on the text itself? And yeah, I would agree with you. It's both and, of course.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, you've already mentioned that the next project is part two.
Part two, because they didn't finish it.
Sure. Okay. And are you working on anything else at the moment?
So that part two is called The Poetry of the Future, okay. Which turns out to be a phrase that not only Marx uses, but Whitman uses, and they may get from each other. So that's kind of interesting. And I know.
I didn't know.
And then I'm writing a little piece, a little book, I think, called What is Poetry?
Okay. which is where we started, really. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening.